Thank you, Glenn, and good afternoon, everyone. This is a rather grand title, isn't it, about learning from overseas experience. Unfortunately, I've really only got some experience to offer from one part of the world, which is a group of countries we speak of as the Nordic countries, Denmark, Sweden, and Finland. And the learnings from these countries came really as a byproduct of studying something else. We got a grant from the Foundation on Research, Science and Technology to do a comparative study of environmental management systems between New Zealand and the Nordic countries. And it was really as a byproduct of that study that we discovered the extensive use which the Nordic countries make of collaborative decision-making procedures. And this was really our starting point. These are greenhouse gas emissions since 1990, measured in gross terms. And you can see the big picture here is simply that the Nordic countries have been very successful at delivering on the commitment they made in the Kyoto Protocol of getting their emissions below their 1990 level. New Zealand, on the other hand, is the clean green one there, is way up on its 1990 level emissions. And a lot of tough decisions were taken in the Nordic countries to deliver on that commitment. They had a big investment in Denmark in developing their wind power industry. A huge amount of public subsidy and commitment went into that. In Sweden, they had big investment programs to change over all their boilers from being fired with oil and gas into being fired with wood chips. There was a big nuclear debate in these countries, which led to a commitment to build more nuclear reactors. Sweden had a big effort on changing its vehicle fleet. So now 38% of their private vehicles are classed as sustainable. They're either electric or they're biofueled or they're hybrids or they have equivalent low emission vehicles. They introduced congestion pricing into a number of these Nordic cities so that when you drive into town, you pay, and what you pay goes across to subsidise the public transport system. And a whole lot of other crunchy decisions have been made as well in agriculture, biodiversity, forestry, water pollution. These are all, from an environmental perspective, pretty amazing achievements. Whoops. People say, well, how comparable are the Nordic countries anyway? And it's just worth saying a few points about that. They're similar to New Zealand in population size, GDP per capita. They're sitting a little wealthier than us, but not as wealthy as Australia. They have a political system, a proportional representation pretty similar to ours. They've been through a Rogenomics sort of phase, the same as we did, of rather tough economic reforms. They're very open, trade-exposed, export-oriented economies with quite large primary sectors. So Denmark is a big dairy exporter, about the same as New Zealand. Finland is a big forest exporter. Sweden has a little bit of both. So they're large primary sectors with prominent role for primary producers in their politics. And they also have fairly much the same kinds of environmental problems that we have in New Zealand. The difference, though, is that they've been very successful in both advancing their economic performance and advancing their environmental performance at the same time, and that's why we wanted to study them. Could you put down the difference in achievement to those countries having greener values than New Zealand? There's quite a lot of international survey data looking at people's values, and when we looked at that, what came out of it was that New Zealand actually rates very green amongst the OECD countries in terms of people's values here. We're in the same bracket as the Nordic countries, and we, in effect, form a little group at the top of the OECD. We're the greenest countries in the OECD. And the gap was not between New Zealand and, say, Sweden or Finland. The gap was between the Nordic countries and New Zealand on the one hand and the rest of the OECD on the other. We are much greener than the OECD average. The difference between New Zealand and the Nordic countries wasn't in how green our values were. The difference was how effective we were in translating our values into actual policies which got results on the ground. And that's where the Nordic countries were doing better than we are. When we looked at a series of case studies comparing these various countries, what really emerged was the importance of collaborative governance as a way of making environmental decisions in the Nordic countries. In the New Zealand tradition, we are very strong on public participation. We put out proposals, we get submissions on them, we have hearings, we run them off to the Environment Court and so on. But in the end, there's a central authority which makes the final decision. They inform themselves by listening to both sides, but then they make the decision. In the Nordic countries, it's a little bit the other way around. They actually empower the stakeholders to negotiate amongst themselves, and they say to them essentially, look, if you can reach a consensus amongst yourselves, we will implement what you have decided. If, on the other hand, you can't reach an agreement amongst yourselves, then we, the politicians, will have to take the decision. This creates quite strong incentives for collaborative behaviour, for encouraging stakeholders in their societies to try and talk to each other and find solutions. And it's grown out of a political convention, which I believe is very important in explaining the differences between them and us. And the political convention which has become established over there is that the politicians, if they get a consensus from a group of stakeholders, they by and large, and there are a couple of exceptions, but by and large they will implement it. In New Zealand, we don't yet have that convention established. These deliberative processes are usually open to all comers, or if they're not fully open, they are widely representative. So you have all the different stakeholders sitting around the table, and they give them plenty of time. And there were six of these processes that we studied. They lasted between a year and 3 years to achieve a consensus report. And the thing that was most striking about them was the extent to which the participants were able to come to grips with a huge amount of detailed information. Information of two kinds. One was the technical information about the issues which they were being asked to deliberate on. And when you compare the participants' understanding of that technical information with the sort of information, a sort of understanding that a New Zealand regional councillor or cabinet minister has when they make a decision, you have to say, golly, the participants in these roundtable processes had a much better grasp of the technical information because of that immersion. But the second kind of information that they immersed themselves in these processes was information about each other's point of view. And that was a really, really important part of what was learned during those processes. And an important part of that was the way in which the science was, in a sense, negotiated in the roundtable situation. Almost all these environmental issues are bedeviled by scientific uncertainty. And you can interpret the scientific uncertainty either as saying this is too risky, we shouldn't do something, or the other way around, that this is a very manageable risk and we need to do it because the risks of not doing something are bigger. And if you just do what we do in New Zealand, which is each side going to the Environment Court hires an expert witness to argue their side of the science, you get an adversarial kind of science, and you don't get a consensus about how to deal with the uncertainty. And so the scientific issues often never really get resolved. And we've seen that, of course, carried forward into our climate policy debates here in New Zealand as well. So the benefit of being able to get a consensus amongst the stakeholders as to how to treat the uncertainty is a very important aspect of the benefits of these kinds of processes. Some of the advantages in these processes, I guess I've already touched on the key point that this speeds up a society's ability to adopt effective policy measures for sustainable development. Now, that isn't immediately obvious because these processes are quite slow. It might take you 3 years to reach agreement on a policy. But if you're taking a 20-year view of progress, as you saw in that initial slide I had about how far countries have moved on reducing their greenhouse gas emissions, if you take that 20-year view, that's where the Nordic countries really seem to get ahead. In New Zealand, we go forward in little lurches, and then we go backwards, and we lurch again forward. And it's a case of the tortoise and the hare. And the Nordic countries are the tortoises. They're using these incremental, compromise-making, very gradual processes. But at the end of 20 years, they've got much further ahead than those of us in New Zealand who get a change of government, something roars this way, and then we change government again, it roars backwards. And at the end of 20 years, it's kind of hard to see what we've achieved. A second big advantage, I guess, of these processes is that they create a supportive environment for implementation. This matters in environmental policy because we have a multi-layered governance system. You can decide something in Wellington, but the implementation of it is going to depend on what regional councils decide to do in Vakaagul or Hokitika or Whangarei. And when we interviewed people at the regional council level in the Nordic countries, what we found was because all the stakeholders had been locked into a consensus and all the political parties had followed the stakeholders into a consensus, that when you got down to the lower level of governance at the regional council or at the district council, you didn't have that same impulse to fight Wellington that you get in the New Zealand system of governance. You know, everybody had kind of bought into, okay, we've pretty much all agreed that we're going to do this, let's get on and get it done. And that was a big change from what we do in New Zealand. Another aspect of this is when you look at data for appeals to the environment courts. They have the same system of environment courts in the Nordic countries that we have in New Zealand, and it's very easy to get access to them over there. You don't have to pay a lot to lodge an appeal. You pay less than you do in New Zealand. But despite that, there are fewer appeals in the Nordic system than we have in New Zealand. And when we spoke with people from the business sector, they said that the absence or relative low level of appeals being exercised against greenfields development projects in the Nordic countries was a plus for them. They could get greater certainty of investment, and they felt that contributed to their competitiveness as economies. And one can contrast that, although we haven't done the interviews, but certainly by looking at the sort of commentary that comes through in the media here, a sense among business investors in New Zealand that the Resource Management Act is creating a lot of uncertainty and a lot of disincentive for investing. And the last point I think I've already touched on, which is that these collaborative processes do have the effect of increasing the influence of science in the decision-making processes. And I've just popped up a little photograph of a Finnish nuclear reactor there because, in a way, it's a little story that really encapsulates the difference here. Finland already has 5 nuclear reactors, and they were trying to decide whether to build a 6th one after a long period in which the politics made it very difficult to build any new nuclear reactors. And in that climate, the Finnish Parliament tried to build a consensus around finding a site to bury in a long-term repository Finland's long-lived nuclear waste. And in the end, as a result of a collaborative process, there was a complete agreement on where to put this nuclear waste, making Finland the first country in the world to decide on a long-term repository for its nuclear waste. And part of that consensus was the Green Party, an anti-nuclear party. And most Green Parties around the world, of course, they don't want to agree to a site for nuclear waste because not having one, in a sense, strengthens the argument they have against nuclear power. But the Finnish Green Party really caught up in the collaborative spirit and they said, look, we've already got all this nuclear waste. We've got to put it somewhere. So we're willing to sign a deal that this is the best and the safest place to put it. And that was a kind of illustration of the power, I think, of the collaborative culture on a very difficult issue. That leads me into my next slide, which is just the outcome of a series of interviews we did with participants in these Nordic processes, asking them why they made such big compromises as part of these processes. We got 3 main answers to that question. The first one was, well, consensus for us means getting implementation And that's really valuable for us. We can do a deal with the people on the other side of this argument, and we can feel confident that if we've made that compromise, that it will stick. It won't be changed around by some subsequent decision-making process. Now, that's not something, as I said earlier, that we in any way have established in New Zealand, and I think, indeed, it's probably the biggest risk for the establishment of collaborative culture in New Zealand, that the elected decision makers still feel that they can just set aside some big outcome of a process like this and impose their own view of what should happen. The second answer we got from these participants was that consensus gives you durability of policy. And if you're doing environmental policy, that's very important, because most environmental problems can only be solved over a multi-generational timescale, whether it's water pollution or the greenhouse gas effect or whatever. And that means that you really need to have both sides of politics locked into a consensus around what's going to happen. And collaboration is a way of getting that. Because if all the main stakeholders agree, then the political parties tend to fall in behind that, and you're not so dependent on the outcome of elections and changing composition of the parliament as you are under traditional systems of governance. The third big reason that people gave us as to why they made compromises was all around securing continued access to power. And that was essentially because in these Nordic countries, you don't get access to power unless you join a collaborative group. And that again comes down to political conventions and the establishment of conventions and systems where collaboration is customarily used. I just want to make two other points about how these compromises got to be made, which are at a different level of analysis. One is that people do opinion polling. They get a sense of what is going to be acceptable to the wider public. So even if you're in a little room and there's just 10 groups, stakeholder groups represented, if you're representing a large organisation, you have to be conscious of how you appear to the wider public. I remember an interview with the leader of the Danish Society for Nature Conservation, who said, as he went into this negotiation with the Danish farmers, our policy is to have only organic dairy farming in Denmark, and our members feel pretty strongly about that. But he also told me that as the collaboration proceeded, they backed away from that. And the reason they backed away from it was because of a perception they formed, partly from polling, that that wouldn't go down to the Danish public. The Danish public saw dairy exporting as a very important economic activity, and this organisation, this nature society, felt that if it was going to continue to gain members and have a high public reputation, it couldn't insist on having only organic. And a second factor, which I think was also important, was simply the moderating effect of a large organisation and the accountability that negotiators had to those organisations. And that was something that worked both ways to the benefit of the collaborative process. Again, an example from Denmark. The leader of the Danish Farmers Union, he said to me, I spent half my time sitting at this table negotiating with all these environmentalists. The other half of my time I had to spend travelling around Denmark having meetings with farmers, persuading them that we had to compromise. So the accountability he had to his members created a situation where he really had to be an active persuader, bringing them into that compromise ground, that middle ground. Gosh, I'm really not getting the knack of running this backwards. Here we go. I don't want to go through these in detail because Alistair's going to speak more about these, but I just thought it's worth flagging. These are some of the key success factors that participants identified when we interviewed them in the Nordic countries. The first of them is not about the process, the individual process. It's about the political context. These are societies in which political leadership and sector leadership is very focused on getting consensus, on getting collaborative approaches to decision making across stakeholders, across government agencies, and across political parties. But we sort of started on this in New Zealand with MMP, and maybe we can move further down this track. We need political mandate for these collaborations, and we need deadlines for them. But we also need that factor I've stressed several times, trust by the participants that what they can agree on will be implemented by the politicians. We need considerable time and resources for the learning process, the consensus building process. This is not a cheap or quick exercise. We need participants who can recognise their interdependence, or to put it more bluntly, the situation has to be almost deadlocked before the participants are going to get serious about negotiating with each other to find a compromise. There has to be accountability of the participants to their sectors. It isn't that good, although this is a bit of a grey area, which I'll talk about later on today. It isn't generally a good idea to say, well, we don't like most of the people from Federated Farmers, so we're going to choose this farmer who's a nice, pliable person and bring him into the process. Rather, having the person that the organisation wants to nominate is rather important for getting the buy-in of that organisation. You need to think about trying to focus the participants on long-term objectives and then milestones as to how you're going to achieve them, with transitions during which adjustment and review and reconsideration can take place. You have to have a strategic sense that there are win-win opportunities for all the participants, or you have to be able to create them. There has to be an agreed protocol as to how the participants are going to behave, what they're going to say in the news media, how they're going to treat each other. There has to be a professional secretariat. They all provided a really valuable part of making these things happen in all the studies we looked at. And finally, you have to have a chairman who, in every one of these case studies I looked at in the Nordic countries, people said to me, so-and-so was the only person in the whole of Finland who could have made this process a success. So the chairman is really crucial, and finding that person is often incredibly important to the success of the whole thing. A lot of people say to me, this must be a quirk of these blonde-haired, blue-eyed people of the North. And I must confess, I've thought about that a lot, and social scientists are always very sceptical about cultural explanations as to why things happen differently. We always prefer to use some kind of institutional or incentive-based explanation for behaviour. But let me just take you through a little bit of history here. Finland didn't start out as a collaborative country. It had a civil war after the First World War. At the end of that, Finnish people locked up 70,000 of their fellow countrymen in these offshore island fortresses, where most of them died in prison. And the bitterness of the Finnish, those events in Finland, hung over and had a politically mobilising effect right through into the 1970s. So this was a rather divided and in many ways a rather bitter political culture that we're talking about. But alongside it, there was this big, ugly neighbour called, in those days, the Soviet Union. And because of the existence of the Soviet Union, the various political parties in Finland who couldn't agree on much did decide they had to reach a consensus on foreign policy and on security policy, and they did that. And that was so successful that they thought, well, perhaps we should use this consensus approach for some of our other long-term issues like superannuation and environment. And in doing that, they were learning a little bit from their neighbours, the Swedes and the Danes. And those were successful as well. And so gradually, over the last 20 or 30 years, Finland has progressively adopted these collaborative approaches as the kind of hallmark of its politics. And so now political scientists looking at these countries say Finland is actually more collaborative in its style than any of the other Nordic countries is. And that's really as a process of leadership, of people recognising they have to do better, they have to be more collaborative, and showing leadership in how it's done. My last slide, at least for the moment, it just brings us back to New Zealand. We do have some cultural predisposition to collaborate in this country. Some of it is in rural contexts. I could give you many examples of this, but I discount them a little bit to this extent, that what they're drawing on is small local context where there's a lot of what you call bonding social capital, where people belong to, they belong to a shared community, and they're willing to talk with each other and to do things in a collective way in a little rural community. This guy up in Raglan mobilised a community to plant a lot of trees and get a lot of agricultural effluent out of the Raglan harbour. But in doing so, he drew on the strong social capital of a small rural community. There are many examples of that. In the wider context in which you're trying to reconcile the different viewpoints of farming, environmentalism, and iwi interests, the story isn't quite so strong. A local government has established traditions of what you might call elected majoritarianism. When you go around New Zealand's regional councils, you won't see many Māori faces. In fact, as I recall it, when I last looked at it, there were no Māori faces on any regional council except for one, Environment Bay of Plenty, which had some Māori seats, which chose to do that. And in the rural areas, the regional councils tend not to have people of an environmental persuasion either, and they're dominated by farmers. So this is not a context in which collaboration is particularly likely to take place. But we do have, despite that flavour of local government, we do have some examples of collaborative governance, which is of a real kind. In other words, it brought really opposing interests into designing collaborative solutions. There was the West Coast Forests Accord in the mid-1980s, the allocation of water in the Waitaki River catchment in the early 1990s, the Fiordland Marine Reserves decisions in the early 2000s. These are, I think, quite impressive examples of collaborative governance. And more recently, just in the last couple of years, we've seen two very ambitious attempts at collaborative governance: the Canterbury Water Management Strategy, which I'm going to talk a little bit more about later on, and the Land and Water Forum, which I participated in, but which Alistair chaired. And it's, I think, now the appropriate moment for him to take over and tell you about that. Thank you.